Chapter 18. What do you call the surest means of self-defense? Some preliminary knowledge of human nature in its relation to the marriage tie. She made an impatient gesture. H, how should you like to marry that kind of a girl? Immensely, if she were my kind of girl in other respects. She took up the argument at another point. You are quite mistaken, if you think such talk does not affect young girls. Una was in a state of the most absurd exultation. She broke off, wondering why S.E. had spoken. Westall reopened a magazine which he had laid aside at the beginning of their discussion. W, what you tell me is immensely flattering to my oratorical talent, but I fear you overrate its effect. I can assure you that Miss Van Sideren doesn't have to have her thinking done for her. She's quite capable of doing it herself. You seem very familiar with her mental processes. Flashed unguardedly from his wife. He looked up quietly from the pages he was cutting. I should like to be, he answered. S.G. interests me. 2. If there be a distinction in being misunderstood, it was one denied to Julia Westall when she left her first husband. Everyone was ready to excuse, and even to defend her. The world she adorned agreed that John Armand was impossible, and hostesses gave a sigh of relief at the thought that it would no longer be necessary to ask him to dine. There had been no scandal connected with the divorce. Neither side had accused the other of the offense euphemistically described as statutory. The Armands had indeed been obliged to transfer their allegiance to a state which recognized desertion as a cause for divorce, and construed the term so liberally that the seeds of desertion were shown to exist in every union. Even Mrs. Armand's second marriage did not make traditional morality stir in its sleep. It was known that S.E. had not met her second husband till after she had parted from the first, and S.E. had, moreover, replaced a rich man by a poor one. Though Clement Westall was acknowledged to be a rising lawyer, it was generally felt that his fortunes would not rise as rapidly as his reputation. The Westalls would probably always have to live quietly and go out to dinner in cabs. Could there be better evidence of Mrs. Armand's complete disinterestedness? If the reasoning by which her friends justified her course was somewhat cruder and less complex than her own elucidation of the matter, both explanations led to the same conclusion. John Armand was impossible. The only difference was that, to his wife, his impossibility was something deeper than a social disqualification. S.E. had once said, in ironical defense of her marriage, that it had at least preserved her from the necessity of sitting next to him at dinner, but S.E. had not then realized at what cost the immunity was purchased. John Armand was impossible, but the sting of his impossibility lay in the fact that he made it impossible for those about him to be other than himself. By an unconscious process of elimination, he had excluded from the world everything of which he did not feel a personal need. Had become, as it were, a climate in which only his own requirements survived. This might seem to imply a deliberate selfishness, but there was nothing deliberate about Armand. He was as instinctive as an animal or a child. It was this childish element in his nature which sometimes for a moment unsettled his wife's estimate of him. Was it possible that he was simply undeveloped, that he had delayed, somewhat longer than is usual, the laborious process of growing up? He had the kind of sporadic shrewdness which causes it to be said of a dull man that he is a fool, and it was this quality that his wife found most trying. Even to the naturalist it is annoying to have his deductions disturbed by some unforeseen aberrancy of form or function, and how much more so to the wife whose estimate of herself is inevitably bound up with her judgment of her husband. Armand's shrewdness did not, indeed, imply any latent intellectual power. It suggested, rather, potentialities of feeling, of suffering, perhaps, in a blind rudimentary way, on which Julia's sensibilities naturally declined to linger. She so fully understood her own reasons for leaving him, that she disliked to think they were not as comprehensible to her husband. She was haunted, in her analytic moments, by the look of perplexity, too inarticulate for words, with which he had acquiesced to her explanations. These moments were rare with her, however. Her marriage had been too concrete a misery to be surveyed philosophically. If S. he had been unhappy for complex reasons, the unhappiness was as real as though it had been uncomplicated. Soul is more bruisable than flesh, and Julia was wounded in every fiber of her spirit. Her husband's personality seemed to be closing gradually in on her, obscuring the sky and cutting off the air, till she felt herself shut up among the decaying bodies of her starved hopes. A sense of having been decoyed by some world-old conspiracy into this bondage of body and soul filled her with despair. If marriage was the slow lifelong acquittal of a debt contracted in ignorance, then marriage was a crime against human nature. She, for one, would have no share in maintaining the pretense, of which as he had been a victim. The pretense that a man and a woman, forced into the narrowest of personal relations, must remain there till the end, though they may have outgrown the span of each other's natures as the mature tree outgrows the iron brace about the sapling. It was in the first heat of her moral indignation that S. he had met Clement Westall. S. he had seen at once that he was interested, and had fought off the discovery, dreading any influence that should draw her back into the bondage of conventional relations. To ward off the peril S. he had, with an almost crude precipitancy, revealed her opinions to him. To her surprise, she found that he shared them. She was attracted by the frankness of a suitor who, while pressing his suit, admitted that he did not believe in marriage. Her worst audacities did not seem to surprise him. He had thought out all that as he had felt, and they had reached the same conclusion. People grew at varying rates, and the yoke that was an easy fit for the one might soon become galling to the other. That was what divorce was for. The readjustment of personal relations. As soon as their necessarily transitive nature was recognized, they would gain in dignity as well as in harmony. There would be no farther need of the ignoble concessions and connivances, the perpetual sacrifice of personal delicacy and moral pride, by means of which imperfect marriages were now held together. Each partner to the contract would be on his mettle, forced to live up to the highest standard of self-development, on pain of losing the other's respect and affection. The low nature could no longer drag the higher down, but must struggle to rise, or remain alone on its inferior level. The only necessary condition to a harmonious marriage was a frank recognition of this truth, and a solemn agreement between the contracting parties to keep faith with themselves, and not to live together for a moment after complete accord had ceased to exist between them. The new adultery was unfaithfulness to self. It was, as Westall had just reminded her, on this understanding, that they had married. The ceremony was an unimportant concession to social prejudice. Now that the door of divorce stood open, no marriage need be an imprisonment, and the contract therefore no longer involved any diminution of self-respect. The nature of their attachment placed them so far beyond the reach of such contingencies that it was easy to discuss them with an open mind, and Julia's sense of security made her dwell with a tender insistence on Westall's promise to claim his release when he should cease to love her. The exchange of these vows seemed to make them, in a sense, champions of the new law, pioneers in the forbidden realm of individual freedom. They felt that they had somehow achieved beatitude without martyrdom. This, as Julia now reviewed the past, she perceived to have been her theoretical attitude toward marriage. It was unconsciously, insidiously, that her 10 years of happiness with Westall had developed another conception of the tie, a reversion, rather, to the old instinct of passionate dependency and possessorship that now made her blood revolt at the mere hint of change. Change? Renewal? Was that what they had called it, in their foolish jargon? Destruction, extermination, rather this rending of a myriad fibers interwoven with another's being. Another? But he was not other. He and she were one, one in the mystic sense which alone gave marriage its significance. The new law was not for them, but for the disunited creatures forced into a mockery of union. The gospel she had felt called on to proclaim had no bearing on her own case. She sent for the doctor and told him she was sure she needed a nerve tonic. She took the nerve tonic diligently, but it failed to act as a sedative to her fears. She did not know what she feared, but that made her anxiety the more pervasive. Her husband had not reverted to the subject of his Saturday talks. He was unusually kind and considerate, with a softening of his quick manner, a touch of shyness in his consideration, that sickened her with new fears. She told herself that it was because she looked badly, because he knew about the doctor and the nerve tonic, that he showed this deference to her wishes, this eagerness to screen her from moral drafts. But the explanation simply cleared the way for fresh inferences. The week passed slowly, vacantly, like a prolonged Sunday. On Saturday the Morning Post brought a note from Mrs. Van Sideren. Would dear Julia ask Mr. Westall to come half an hour earlier than usual, as there was to be some music after his talk? Westall was just leaving for his office when his wife read the note. She opened the drawing room door and called him back to deliver the message. He glanced at the note and tossed it aside. W, what a bore. I shall have to cut my game of rackets. Well, I suppose it can't be helped. Will you write and say it's all right? Julia hesitated a moment, her hand stiffening on the chair back against which she leaned. You mean to go on with these talks? She asked. Why not? He returned, and this time it struck her that his surprise was not quite unfeigned. The discovery helped her to find words. You said you had started them with the idea of pleasing me. Well, I told you last week that they didn't please me. Last week? Oh, he seemed to make an effort of memory. I thought you were nervous then. You sent for the doctor the next day. It was not the doctor I needed. It was your assurance, my assurance. Suddenly she felt the floor fail under her. She sank into the chair with a choking throat, her words, her reason slipping away from her like straws down a whirling flood. Clement, she cried, isn't it enough for you to know that I hate it? He turned to close the door behind them, then he walked toward her and sat down. W, what is it that you hate? He asked gently, as he had made a desperate effort to rally her routed argument. I can't bear to have you speak, as if our marriage were like the other kind, the wrong kind. When I heard you there, the other afternoon, before all those inquisitive gossiping people, proclaiming that husbands and wives had a right to leave each other whenever they were tired, or had seen someone else, Westall sat motionless, his eyes fixed on a pattern of the carpet. You have ceased to take this view, then? He said as she broke off. Why, you no longer believe that husbands and wives are justified in separating under such conditions? Under such conditions? She stammered. Yes, I still believe that, but how can we judge for others? What can we know of the circumstances? He interrupted her. I thought it was a fundamental article of our creed that the special circumstances produced by marriage were not to interfere with the full assertion of individual liberty. He paused a moment. I thought that was your reason for leaving Armand. She flushed to the forehead. It was not like him to give a personal turn to the argument. It was my reason, she said simply. Well, then why do you refuse to recognize its validity now? I only say that one can't judge for others. He made an impatient movement. This is mere hair splitting. What you mean is that, the doctrine having served your purpose when you needed it, you now repudiate it. Well, she exclaimed, flushing again, what if I do? What does it matter to us? Westall rose from his chair. He was excessively pale, and stood before his wife with something of the formality of a stranger. It matters to me, he said in a low voice, because I do not repudiate it. Well, and because I had intended to invoke it as, he paused and drew his breath deeply. She sat silent, almost deafened by her heartbeats. As a complete justification of the course I am about to take. Julia remained motionless. W, what course is that? She asked. He cleared his throat. I mean to claim the fulfillment of your promise. For an instant the room wavered and darkened. Then she recovered a torturing acuteness of vision. Every detail of her surroundings pressed upon her. The tick of the clock, the slant of sunlight on the wall, the hardness of the chair arms that she grasped, were a separate wound to each sense. My promise, she faltered. You're part of our mutual agreement, to set each other free, if one or the other should wish to be released. She was silent again. He waited a moment, shifting his position. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.